You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I don't think it is right to identify Islam with violence. This is not just, and it is not true.
Pope Francis suggests that drugs, unemployment, and general anomie may be more responsible for religious terrorism than religion. Is he right? My guests Daniela Pellad and Martin Plaut will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including exiled Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen denies responsibility for the botched coup d'etat in Turkey, protesters once again running the considerable risk of demonstrating in Ethiopia, and the erasure of 50 centuries of Norwegian skiing history by idiots with a penknife. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Daniela Pellad, Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Martin Plaut, Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and author of Promise and Despair, The First Struggle for a Non-Racial South Africa. Welcome both. We will start with Turkey. Now, those that have been trying to catch up with the country's politics and history amid the excitement of the last few weeks may have wondered whether or not Fethullah Gulen, enigmatic nemesis of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is a living, breathing person or a mythological bogeyman in the manner of Emmanuel Goldstein in 1984. By way of reminder that he does in fact exist, Gulen has spoken to CNN and denied, with some caveats, involvement in the other weekend's abortive coup d'etat. Daniela, first of all, do we think Gulen actually has anything like the power that Erdogan credits him with?
He does have very significant power in terms of the international network, charities, schools. I mean, they're, you know, in America, not just regionally, but also in America. I'm sure this is slightly added to by, as you said, this image of sort of reclusive, mysterious man.
Steepling his fingers and stroking a cat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the more, I'm sure there must have been some sympathisers amongst the supporters of the coup. But the problem is that any accusation that Erdogan makes right now just seems to have zero credibility. The idea that Gulen was the sort of power behind this whole coup and has been plotting the destruction of his government, it seems implausible. I'm sure he'd be delighted if Erdogan fell from power. But considering the sort of sweeping purge, basically, that it's been going on in Turkey ever since, I take everything that Erdogan says, and certainly before, with a great pinch of salt.
Martin, Gulen himself says that he had nothing to do with orchestrating the coup, but does acknowledge that certain of his supporters may have had something to do with the coup, independent of his influence. That actually sounds fairly plausible, doesn't it?
It does indeed. I mean, since he seems to have a heck of a lot of supporters in Turkey, how would it be possible for anyone to stage a coup of this size and not include some of his people? He also seems to be a fairly moderate sort of man, although I do remember the Muslim Brotherhood once upon a time appearing fairly moderate Egypt.
And as we have discussed in this space many times, moderate is a very relative term.
It is indeed. But, I mean, you know, he does have great influence. I mean, he's supposed to have 200,000 volunteers in 100 countries. And when the coup took place, one of the first things that happened afterwards was that the hospital in Mogadishu, the Turkish hospital in Mogadishu, was told to close because they were Gulenists. And so, you know, it just goes to show how deep and far his spread was. And he clearly did have influence, does have influence. And that is, I suppose, why the president has to purge so deeply and so radically.
One of the interesting diplomatic wrangles prompted by this fiasco, Daniela, has been the fact that Gulen, of course, lives in the United States, somewhat inconveniently for all concerned. Turkey has demanded that the United States hand him over. Is that likely to happen, do we think?
They can demand all they like. They know that there isn't any chance of them doing this. As I understand, there's no legal basis for this, and there's no reason why the US would extradites him. They don't need to, and they're just not going to. But, of course, he loses nothing by demanding extradition. It's been very interesting to note the way that the anti-Gulen war has been carried on in the Turkish press and also in the English language Turkish press, and you know, the sort of media onslaught, many, many supposedly serious pieces of analysis pointing the finger still at him. And this is just point scoring, trying to legitimise Erdogan's position. I mean, you know, he's going to stay put. He's not going anywhere.
Gulen did, Martin, possibly rather mischievously, possibly sincerely, hard to say, suggested that the entire coup did, as he put it, seem something like a staged scenario, thereby sort of, I guess, reheating this theory that started doing the rounds almost instantly, that the whole thing was a stunt put up by Erdogan in order to permit the purge he has been undertaking since, which strikes me as somewhat far-fetched, I have to say, but there is nothing about this whole thing that doesn't strike me as far-fetched.
Indeed. I mean, well, he also said that it was a bit more like a Hollywood film than a coup, which, I mean, there were so many elements of what went on that seemed so unlikely. I mean, the fighters following the president's jet, you know, not shooting him down, but having the possibility of shooting him down. I mean, the whole thing seems utterly far-fetched. I mean, if you're going to stage a coup, you have to stage a coup, and you have to actually, you know, be prepared to kill anybody that stands in your way. And these troops were prepared to risk their own lives, but not to kill. Well, what is that all about?
Coups do sometimes go wrong.
Oh, frequently.
As well.
Absolutely frequently.
You're talking as if you've personally been involved in several, Martin.
Well, I've been in Liberia when there was an attempted coup, and I stood outside the palace in Monrovia trying to work out whether the president was dead inside or about to, you know, spring forth alive and well. And all the troops around the presidential palace thought exactly the same. They didn't know which way to jump, whether to go with the revolt or against it. So, I mean, yeah, that's what they often feel like. Well, often. I've seen one, you know. I'm going to generalise.
Daniela, another diplomatic brouhaha that has ensued is, of course, between Turkey and Europe. Germany's Vice Chancellor, Sigmar Gabriel, has said today that Europe shouldn't be blackmailed re-visa liberalisation. This is, of course, a reference to the deal that was struck before the coup, whereby Turkey would cooperate vis-a-vis staunching the outflows of refugees from Syria in return for visa liberalisation for Turkish citizens. Where does that bargain now stand? Have we figured that out yet?
Well, I don't. I mean, in March, when it was agreed, it didn't seem very likely that it would ever come to fruition. It seemed even less likely now. And it was always going to be open for blackmail, because this wasn't part of a general effort to move Turkey closer to the EU in a sort of wider progress. This is just about one issue, that of refugees, and the hope that Turkey would somehow solve this problem, no matter how the refugees would be treated in Turkey. And it has worked, as much as something, an arrangement of this kind can seem to be workable. The flow has been staunched somewhat. But obviously Turkey was going to do this. Obviously Turkey has this amazing set of cards to play, and they're going to threaten, right, we're going to let people in. And even just tens of thousands of new refugees coming through could have an enormous impact. And, you know, given the current climate in Europe, the idea that Turkey is any closer to membership, or even the idea of visa-free access, seems so implausible. I didn't think at the time it was going to happen, and I see even less likelihood of it happening now.
Can I just say one thing on this, which is worthwhile noting, is that the refugee issue, from the European point of view, has almost been solved, because the Turkish route is now blocked, certainly at the moment, and it's unlikely it's going to be unblocked. The Israel route, which was through the Sinai, is closed. The route via Spain and the Spanish colonies of Ceuta and Melilla are completely blocked, and you can't get via the western route via the Canaries. The only route open now is Libya, and Libya is being blocked as soon as possible. So actually, Europe is pretty close to solving, in its terms, the refugee situation.
I think that makes Erdogan's the threats from Turkey even more pertinent, though, because just as they think that the problem has gone away, if he lets in 10, 20, 30,000 refugees, I think that will have an enormous impact.
Okay, well, let's move along now. One of the recurring motifs of this century has been the determination by many to reason away every act of Islamist violence as being nothing at all to do with Islam. However clear the actual perpetrators tend to be that, as far as they're concerned, it is, and very much so. The latest tophosic for other more sophisticated explanations is Pope Francis, who responded as follows when reporters on his flight back from Poland asked him about last week's murder of a French priest, Father Jacques Hamel, by self-styled jihadis.
I don't think it is right to identify Islam with violence. This is not just, and it is not true. I have had a long dialogue with the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University on how they think, and I know how they think. They seek peace and dialogue. These are fundamentalist groups, and I ask myself, how many young people are there that we Europeans have left devoid of values? Those who do not have jobs, take drugs, drink alcohol, and then enroll in fundamentalist groups.
Daniela, it could be argued that being Pope is by definition putting you very much in the wishful thinking business. Is this wishful thinking by the Pope?
If one wanted to be charitable to the Pope, which I think is, it seems currently fashionable, you could say that it's something very important. He makes this point that Islam is not synonymous with terrorism. And given that a lot of people do listen to the Pope, that's an important statement to make. But I think he muddies the issue enormously when, especially, he says, oh, young people have no money, they turn to drink and drugs, and then they become Islamic fundamentalists.
Yeah, I mean, how does he explain unemployed young people who drink and take drugs and don't become Islamic fundamentalists?
Yeah, it's not really a very convincing analysis. So there's a symbolic importance to what he said, but I think, as with many things with the Holy Father, he's doing quite well on the old image front, and the idea of, you know, his role as one promoting peace and reconciliation and tolerance. But if you go beyond the surface, there's lots of things still about Catholicism which one might argue was incompatible with the modern world in terms of contraception and so on and so forth. So he's inhabiting this kind of very esoteric world where Islam, religion, Catholicism, nothing to do with war, nothing to do with violence, not only a force for goodness.
Martin, I think you can see what the Pope is trying to do here. He is trying to remind his flock that the absolutely colossal, vast, overwhelming majority of Muslims are as horrified by Islamist violence as anybody else, and I'm sure that's true. But this is something we've heard over and over again, that whenever somebody commits some dreadful crime, explicitly announcing that they are doing it in the name of Islam, a large amount of Western liberal opinion insists that no, that's not why they're doing it. Shouldn't we take terrorists at their word vis-a-vis their motives?
I think if one's going to be serious about this, I don't think it's a story to which you can give a simple yes or no answer. I mean, clearly. In reality, there are elements clearly of Islam which are conducive to violence, and you can read into the Quran exactly that reading of it, and people do, and they do it. And one only has to look at the first, you know, couple of hundred years of the history of Islam to see that it was closely associated with the sword. But you can equally say that about a lot of religions. And I mean, I came across, Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka who were blood-curdling in their antagonism to the Tamils in the north of Sri Lanka, and who were the people who were egging on the violence against the Tamil community. So it is not possible to say that a particular religion is for or against peace, or that a particular religion is in any way responsible or not responsible for conflict. All of these things are true.
This is the argument with which I personally agree, that people build gods in their own image rather than the other way around.
I think that's absolutely right. Of course, your wisdom is correct.
That's not something I hear often. Daniela, he also went on to say that terrorism grows when there's no other option, when money is made a god and it, instead of the person, is put at the centre of the world economy. Does that, I don't know, it may have lost something in the translation, but does that actually mean anything?
Sorry, Holy Father, that doesn't mean anything at all. And I'm not quite sure what he wants to see put in place of money, or if that's some sort of solution for the world's ills. It is the kind of sort of wishy-washy, touchy-feely, happy-clappy kind of position. And I, you know, he seems like, you know, as Pope's go, he seems like a very nice chap. It reminds me of the sort of thing that you see shared on social media, the background of a kitten.
or a sunset.
Yeah,
on a JPEG.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that money is the root of all evil obviously has its roots in Judeo-Christian doctrine. But as I said, he's not coming up with any kind of alternative, is he?
He's really not, or at least not on the strength of this address to reporters in the back of his aircraft. I mean, Martin, is there an imaginable useful role the Pope can play when discussing divinely inspired terrorism?
I think there is, and I completely disagree with what you just said. I mean, I actually think there's a fundamentally important position that people, you use religion, and religion is used to maintain a set of moral criteria. Now, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. But I mean, I have seen in places in Africa where all you could appeal to was the fact that people were either Christians or Muslims to stop them from doing some of the worst atrocities that I've ever seen. And, you know, those are important things that you can hold by. And, you know, you go to places like Eastern Congo. All that is left after years, decades of, you know, absolutely the most appalling violence are the churches, and the churches are still revered, and the churches still fulfill a role. That is based on religion. So on the one hand, one can see, point to the bad side of religion, but the idea that, you know, and this kind of anarcho, value-free youth that rampages through cities in the West, they are somehow better because they have no religion, I think that is a vacuous position.
I haven't come across many of these anarcho gangs of youth rampaging through cities in the West. Okay.
Okay, well, on that happy thought, we are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellid and Martin Plaut. Coming up next, is there perhaps an Ethiopian spring in the offing?
Monocle rather likes being left on the shelf. Well, the bookshelf. In partnership with our friends at Publishers Gestalten in Berlin, we're creating a library of exciting, desirable, and very useful books. We've already launched The Muscular and Handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living, The Inspiring Monocle Guide to Good Business, and also The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes. Then there's our growing line of city guide books that includes Rio de Janeiro, New York, Tokyo, Madrid, Hong Kong, and Bangkok, with 10 new guides to be added in 2016 alone. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. Buy our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com or find them on the shelves of all great bookstores.
What is Culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows. There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fistfights, and everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there? Well, when we're not enjoying the after party, we're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like how do you adapt a novel and how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellid and Martin Plaut. Now, it takes a certain amount of nerve to undertake public protest in Ethiopia, not a country historically noted for an enthusiasm for participatory democracy. So the tens of thousands who took to the streets this weekend in Gonder, in the Amhara region of the country's north, clearly have serious grievances. No violence has been reported in this weekend's protests, though 10 people were killed in Gonder last month in a confrontation with armed police. Martin, briefly and basically, what is going on here?
Wow. It's a complex story. Essentially, when the current government comes to power in 1991, they do so on the basis that they are going to go for ethnic federalism. So they chop up the whole of Ethiopia and say, you are now, from now on, you're a Tigrayan, you are an Oromo, you are an Amhara. And they give each person a state and they have their own little state legislature and language and so forth and so on. That is the basic system that happened when the Tigray People's Liberation Front came to power. And that's how they did it. The problem with this is that once you embed the ethnic nature of everybody into a situation, as soon as you really then rule it only from the Tigrayans, who make up only 6 or 7% of the population, but assume that each of these ethnic groups will have somebody, a front man for you, who basically does your bidding, you are setting up a terribly difficult situation. And so a lot of people are now finally saying, we've had enough, we're not going to be ruled by the Tigrayans, even though it's one of their front men who happens to be an Amhara or an Oromo, whoever it is. We want actual power, and we're damned if we're going to lose our land. So the Oromo are furious that Addis Ababa, which is growing very fast, is just gobbling up all of their farmland. And this area around Gonder was furious that they are being seen as, although they are clearly Amhara, that they are being dominated by the Tigrayans, and that they see themselves as having no hope in running their own state of affairs. So ethnic federalism is basically coming apart in Ethiopia, and that is what is really behind all of this.
Daniela, is there much cause for optimism that these protests are either going to end well and or accomplish what the protesters are hoping they might?
Well, I think what's troubling and what human rights organisations have highlighted has been the government response to this is rather heavy-handed. So when protest is met with heavy-handed response, the consequences are rarely good. Ethiopia is seen as a key ally of the West. Ethiopian soldiers perform key peacekeeping missions around the continent. So in terms of international pressure, I'm not really sure that much of that will be forthcoming.
Martin, is this the kind of thing which could acquire national momentum?
It could. One just doesn't. It's difficult to know because the army is still really based on the Tigray, but they're only 6% of the 6-7% of the population. You can't run a country like that forever. The East, which one never hears about, the Somali region, has been in ferment for years. The South, which is the Oromo population, is about 40% of the entire population, is deeply unhappy about what is going on. And they've always been very badly treated. Both these areas were incorporated at the end of the 19th century into the Ethiopian state. And they've never been happy about it. I mean, the Oromo used to be called Gala. Gala means slave. And, you know, that is how they were treated, even under Haile Selassie. So this is a very unstable situation. And, you know, the problem really is that Meles Zenawi, who came to power in 1991, was a genius at running these things. I mean, one of the cleverest men I ever met, and, you know, a brilliant man. But his successor, Haile Mariam Desalegn, is not. And he doesn't have the legitimacy to really do it. So although they've tried to continue Meles' policies, you know, the wheels are possibly coming off, but it's difficult to predict the future.
Just finally on this one, and with all due recognition that it is difficult to predict the future, as Daniela was saying, previous government responses to such protests have been somewhat heavy-handed, to understate matters wildly. By the best guesses of Human Rights Watch, 400 people were killed in Oromo last year. How are they likely to respond to this one?
In the same way. They don't really have this. There's only one plan in the rule book. But as you were also pointing out, you know, the United States is deeply in bed with the Ethiopian government because of their role in Somalia. The Ethiopian troops are holding Somalia together. And if they disappear, Somalia will fall to bits. Al-Shabaab will link up with Al-Qaeda, and you then have a deeply unhappy situation all the way through into the Horn of Africa, which is the last thing that Washington wants.
Okay, well, finally tonight we will look to Norway, a nation currently mourning the destruction of a much-beloved historical artefact. The 5,000-year-old stone carving on the island of Tro, apparently of a man skiing, which inspired the logo for the 1994 Winter Olympics in Lillehammer. A pair of visiting youths have scored the carving with some species of sharp implement, apparently out of an earnest desire to render the ancient engraving clearer for subsequent viewers. Daniela, my first response was to despair somewhat of the youth of today, really, because there's a traditional response when presented with an opportunity to graffito or carve into a figure, and all they've done is tried to make it clearer rather than adding the traditional appendage.
There are sadly few details about the graffiti artists involved, and I'd like to know whether they were 5-year-old boys or 15, and that would make quite an important difference. It's hard. On one way, you want to take this very seriously as a desecration of a national treasure, and I feel for the Norwegians and their heritage. On the other hand, you know, who knows? 5,000 years ago, this might have been the handiwork of a 5-year-old or a 15-year-old, and this precious symbol might in turn be an element of graffiti. So perhaps they improved it? Did they update it for the modern world, or is that hopelessly insensitive of me?
The boys have apologised, or at least been compelled to, by their parents. There is some talk now, though, Martin, of prosecution. Should there be?
Gosh, that's a thought.
Are these anarcho youth rampaging through?
Are you maintaining your hard line against anarcho youth?
No, not really. What I think the people who should be prosecuted are the Norwegian authorities. Why did they allow people to get that close to a precious artifact? Why was there not protective glass in front of them? Duh.
That seems a reasonable response. Daniela, it does put one in mind of the botched restoration of an Ecce Homo in Spain a few years ago, which became instantly viral. It was obviously a much less significant work, but listeners may recall that some well-meaning parishioner tried to restore a 100-year-old fresco, and instead, I don't know really what you could describe what it ended up looking like. Sort of a
smiley.
Yeah, a potato with a wig on it. But more than 150,000 people subsequently descended on this struggling small town in order to see it.
Well, this is it. I mean, that restoration was so enormously botched that it actually became something of an artwork itself, and a destination. It became a destination for people wanting to see this very famous, enormous mistake. This kind of goes back to my point that sometimes these bits of graffiti and these sort of mismanaged and mistakes are actually, they hold something very much more touching. I mean, we think about the graffiti we find in Pompeii or other ancient cities that actually tell us a lot more about the people of that time and say something quite touching. Now, I think they might be stretching it a bit to look at this, the Norwegian incident with that. And you might be right. It might have said something more telling about our times had they drawn a certain appendage on it.
Well, Martin, as an anarcho youth yourself, did you never commit an act of petty vandalism?
I'm not going to admit to any. But let me ask you a question.
Please.
What about the, in your own country, there's this whole business with I can't remember its proper name now, but about Ayers Rock.
Uluru.
Say that again.
Uluru.
Okay. People used to wander up and down this and climb all over it, and now that's seen as desecration. I mean, how do you feel about that?
I think actually, and unfortunately we are running out of time, but that has actually been handled quite well in that, in my understanding, that it's not actually banned to climb on it. There's just signs up saying that, you know, this is an important site to a lot of people, so it would be pretty bad manners if you did.
Or
drew an appendage, right, which I think is pretty reasonable.
Sounds good idea.
On that conciliatory note, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Martin Plaut and Daniela Pellet, thank you both very much. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sai Villafuerte and Jacob Ladona. Our studio manager was George McDonough. More music next at 1900. Rob Bound is in with The Culture Show, and I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.